Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 6:06 British Summer Time. Well, this was an interesting day in here today, yet again. We certainly live in interesting times. But the one of the main piece of news that came out today was those retail sales figures, which I mentioned in the audio yesterday, and they were ahead of estimates. Now, the result of that was that because you had higher retail sales, that points towards greater inflation, which would point toward further rate hikes, which in turn strengthened the dollar, which had been down around an area of potential support, which turned out to be true support. And because the dollar rallied, you had some of the precious metals coming off rather sharply. Now they've come off their lows since then, but silver is currently at 1192. It's down 18. The low was at 1177, and gold is currently at 631. The low was at 627. So it's been quite volatile since we had that news. Now that news wasn't immediate, and certainly the euro or the dollar moved immediately after that news, and the euro appreciated to 120. Sorry, the dollar appreciated against the euro to 127.17. It's currently at 127.32, but it's traded around that level quite a lot. It's been up and down quite a bit, but we are seeing the strength of the dollar coming through in here later on in the session. So, this is taking the wind out of the sails of the precious metals for the time being. The question is, just because we've had this retail sales figure, does that necessarily mean that we're going to see rate increases in at the next meeting? There are a number of different pieces of data that are coming out over the next 6 weeks, and any one of which could be the deciding factor. Right now, the markets are thinking, or the sentiment is very much towards another rate hike, which means that we're probably going to see a little bit of weakness in the precious metals in the short term. And you see that government bonds too are starting to weaken in here. I put the chart of the Bund in the interesting chart section today, but you'll also see that the treasuries are down 12 points and gilts are down a third of one full point. They're at 108.64. So that's more or less the recap for today. Equity markets were relatively steady. I closed my long in the FTSE because what I would have liked to have seen was for it to follow through on yesterday's good rally off the lows. We didn't really see that. And when I saw it starting to come off earlier on today, I took the profit because it was really quite a speculative position in the first place. Since I actually did, I think I probably closed it out close to the low of the day, and it rallied up, and I think it only closed down 3 points on the day, but it didn't have that follow through that I was hoping for. I'm probably going to hold on to, well, I'm not probably, I'm going to hold on to my silver and my gold, at least for the moment. I think that there's quite clearly some support around $12 for silver. It has pierced that, not by very much though, and I certainly wouldn't want to panic too early with that one. There is the sort of the short term uptrend is still very much intact, and it would need to fall below $11 for that to be for that view to change. I'm not anticipating that's going to happen. And coffee also was down in here sharply today. It was down 42 points on the September contract. It's at 14.08. That's still, even though it's leaving a tail on the weekly chart, an upside tail, that still looks like a breakout to me, and I'm still holding my coffee positions. But this being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio, so I'll move into some of those bigger picture themes, starting out with stock markets, and particularly Wall Street. Well, we think that Wall Street is in a secular bear market, and we define that as a generational long period of PE ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And interestingly enough, you'll see that PE chart that I posted for the that came from that someone very kindly sent in from DataStream for Japan. And those PEs have been coming down gradually for the last 15 or 16 years, and they're starting to come back to normality now. Now, PEs are not a timing tool, so we wouldn't be trading on the back of a chart like that, but it is interesting to see that Japanese PEs are coming back into an area where they've traded well prior to that very big upswing we had, which turned out to be an enormous bubble in the Japanese markets during the 80s. So it's looking like Japan is starting to return to reasonable valuations. And when we think about how long it took Japan to come back to a reasonable valuation, and you apply that same methodology to the US, well, we're still very early, we're in the very early stages, really, of this secular bear market in the US. Well, I suppose not very early. We've been in it for 6 years now. But the main point is that it's not over. Now, you might ask, well, what's the difference between a bear market and a bull market when you see that Japan gave up so much of the gains, whereas, for example, the Dow Jones is still very close to its all-time highs? And the answer to that question is liquidity, because when the Japanese market burst because they went in and they tightened and they tightened and they tightened, and they killed it off in spectacular fashion. Well, what we saw in the US in 1999, 2000 was they started to tighten, and when the crash started in the Nasdaq, they started cutting rates dramatically, and we came down very, very aggressively. And they pumped in liquidity like there was no tomorrow, which saw the market fall off, yes, but it didn't collapse. The Nasdaq collapsed, but the S&P and the Dow Jones did not collapse in the same way. And they've been able to rally quite significantly since then. So when we look at Japan and we look at the US, the difference is liquidity. And there was plenty of studies done by the Fed at the time, and they were aiming to avoid a Japan-style deflation. And the concern at the time certainly was most definitely in the deflationary camp. Now, at that point, they were going to do whatever it took to avoid that type of deflation in the US markets. And they pumped liquidity with abandon. Then you had 9/11, and that provided another scare which sparked even greater deflationary fears, and they pumped in liquidity. Now, of course, this wasn't the first time they did that. You had long-term capital management and the Russian debt default and the Asian financial crisis, the Y2K, that's not in any particular order, all of which were opportunities for the central banks to pump in liquidity into the system, trying to avoid deflation. And in the last 20 years, inflation has not really been a problem. And they were more than happy to veer on the side of inflationary risk in an effort to avoid deflation than they were concerned about killing off inflation, because inflation was not deemed to be a threat at all. I mean, I'm sure you remember back in the 90s, where inflation or growth without inflation was being touted as a new paradigm, and I think is still being touted in some corners with the same view. But what we've had since then is a massive injection of liquidity, and that has helped to stoke a new inflationary cycle. The fact of the matter is that government bond yields have been in a downtrend for the last 20 years, just about, and it looks like they're starting to bottom out. And when you've got 30-year yields at 5% and they're holding there right now, that looks like it's starting to break up from a base. Well, you can't have rising government bond yields. Excuse me. You can't have rising government bond yields without some sort of threat of inflation. Or it's really the other way around. Inflation causes the rising of government bond yields because you have the rising interest rates. And one of our main investment themes is supply elasticity means rising demand. And what that is basically about is that resources had been in a bear market for a very long time, more than 20 years. Any of the marginal producers had pretty much gone out of business, and those that stayed in business had to get clever about it. And they cut back, and they only mined the richest seams, and there was very little money for investment. And now, because you have 6 billion people living in the world, 3.5 billion of which live in Asia, and everyone And excuse me, everyone who lives in Asia or in emerging markets like in China, India, Indonesia, Pakistan, the Middle East, and South America, and indeed Africa, they aspire to our standard of living in the Western world. And they're intent on getting that way, and with whatever needs to be done. Which means that there's going to be an enormous draw, and there is an enormous drawdown on supplies of industrial commodities. And that's why we've seen the enormous run-ups in some of the industrial metals. But the thing is that when you have the demographic issue that you have in the Middle East, where something like 60% of people are under the age of 30, and you have a very similar story in India, which is over 1 billion people and growing because they don't have the kind of one-child policy that China has, and indeed China has 1.3 billion people. And that's because it's a communist country. It's very difficult to believe what their statistics are proving, or claiming, I should say. But what that means is that that number of people entering the workforce, they will need jobs, they will need housing, and they aspire to our standard of living. So the draw that's been on commodities, the demand, which has pushed these up to levels we haven't seen in 20 years, at least in nominal terms, because obviously inflation adjusted, these things are still quite cheap. What we do see is that this, because of the demographic issues, will last for an incredibly long time, quite a bit longer than most people anticipate, and it could be for the next generation. But of course, because you have rising commodity prices, and of course that's not to mention oil. Oil is at $74 right now, and in a very stable uptrend, so that really does look like it's only going one way. And of course, the demand for oil across the emerging markets, regardless of how efficient they are, the number of people, if there's just per capita usage of oil going up, is really quite spectacular. Well, because you have rising commodity prices just across the board, that means that sooner or later, higher commodity prices do feed into inflation. Now, it might be with a lag, certainly. It might be a 1 year, it might be an 18-month lag, or it might be a 2 year lag, but sooner or later, higher commodity prices feed into headline inflation. And that generally sparks rising interest rates. Rising interest rates are an incredible headwind for stock markets, and the whole maxim over the years where people said that if bonds go up, stock markets go down. Well, it's quite conceivable that bonds go down and stock markets go down at the same time because rising government bond yields make the cost of capital quite a bit higher. Now, of course, that's not to say that these things are going to happen in a linear fashion. Nothing does, especially, and if anyone who's ever looked at stock charts or charts of any description in the markets will know that nothing happens in a linear fashion. You get rolling waves, which means that for a couple of years you'll get inflationary pressures, which will push interest rates up. Those pressures will abate, and the fears of deflation may well appear again. You'll have cuts in interest rates, liquidity will be pushed out, and that liquidity will spark the next round of inflation. But what generally we should see is a gradually rising government bond yields, higher commodity prices over the long term, and the US markets in particular feeling the brunt of that because of the secular bear market. Now, that's not to say that all stock markets are going to be in the same way. Particularly those stock markets in emerging Europe, sorry, excuse me, emerging Asia, are those markets that benefit directly from the commodity boom, which is much of South America. And we would expect those to do remarkably well because the for Asia at least, you'll have the demographics and the growth boom associated with any young population when it enters the workforce. And we're seeing that right now. And in South America, we're seeing it because they're one of the biggest producers of commodities. Europe is sort of in between, and it's certainly not in a bear market right now, but is it going to outperform markets like India? Probably not. And Japan is just ending a secular bear market, so of the developed markets, Japan is probably our best bet, and of the emerging markets, India, because of governance, democracy, rule of law, developed stock markets, that sort of thing. I suppose the easy way of putting it is that if you put your money into India for 20 years, the chances are it'll still be there when you come back for it. Whereas in any communist country, you risk expropriation by the government at any time. And I think we saw plenty of good examples of that in Russia. So, excuse me. So that pretty much covers the stock markets. Now, in a sort of a related term, you have this massive liquidity injection, and because of the liquidity, you have inflation fears rising, which looks very much towards gold and the precious metals. Gold, which had been an absolute dog in anyone's portfolio for such a long time, bottomed at about $250. That was when Gordon Brown sold most of the Bank of England's gold. Actually, I think it was half the Bank of England's gold. And I think Rothschilds closed their gold desk, and that was climactic activity. So when we look at the gold charts, we can see that it's now in quite a consistent uptrend, and it's starting to appreciate in just about every currency. And what that tells us is that because gold is appreciating in just about every currency, that tells us that people are starting to look at gold as a real store of capital. And the fact that central banks around the world are flooding the market with liquidity and more or less stoking inflation stealthily, investors are starting to get a real idea that gold or fixed assets are a real store of value, and anything that has an inelastic supply, which is obviously gold and silver, platinum and palladium, fine art, or diamonds. And we can see that all of these things are starting to go up in price. So that cycle will last as long as the inflationary cycle lasts, and that could be really quite a long time. So the inflationary cycle, which is a bear market for bonds, a bull market for commodities, and a bull market for precious metals, are all go hand in hand. The growth story in Asia is obviously linked with that quite closely. Now, of course, the next asset class that we should look at are the currencies. And because you have just about all central banks are increasing liquidity, that means that we haven't had any spectacular moves in the reserve currencies in particular. You've had a move, we look at the dollar index, or we look at how the euro or the yen are moving, and when the euro moves from 120 to 130, that is obviously a big move for a lot of markets. But when you think about it, and you'll see this point very clearly from the charts I posted today, the Eurozone has a target inflation rate of 2%. It has a target of 4% for money supply growth. And it's not hitting either of those targets. Inflation is above 2%, and money supply is growing at over 8%. Now, if the Eurozone were to actually meet their own targets, the euro would appreciate not from 120 to 130. It would probably appreciate from wherever it is now, 127, to more like 160 or 170 in very short order. And the fact that it hasn't done that is not so much a fact that the Eurozone are not the Euro, the ECB is not meeting its own targets. Their effort is to make sure that their currency is stable. And because all currencies are doing more or less the same thing, we're not really getting very big moves in the reserve currencies, because no country wants to have a strong currency because they want to protect their manufacturing base because of the competitive nature of globalization. So that means that you're probably not going to see very big moves in currencies until something upsets the apple cart with regard to the amount of liquidity that's getting pumped into the system. The area that does have some potential to move is the Asian dollar index, because you have growth stories here. Singapore is looking to become the Switzerland of Asia. Korea is developing, and China is very gradually starting to let its currency appreciate. And we can see that when you look at the Asian dollar index, you'll find that in the chart library, that does look like it's starting to break up from a base right now. It's at 105. The peak before the Asian financial crisis was at 130. So even though you can't trade this, it does look like the Singapore dollar and the Chinese yuan and the Korean won are probably the main constituents there, and the ones that most mirror the appreciation of the currency. So that's I suppose the last asset class. We don't usually talk about housing because obviously you can't really chart housing. But when you look at the inflationary cycle, with rising interest rates, you they every time rising interest rate or interest rates rise, they make a call on fixed rate mortgages. Sorry, floating rate mortgages. So the number of floating rate mortgages in an economy or in any country is going to be in direct relation to the amount of risk that is associated with that housing market. Any housing market that has a large number of floating rate mortgages, it does mean that if we are in a new inflationary environment and interest rates are going up, every time interest rates go up, floating rate mortgage holders are getting a margin call. In the US, where the vast majority of people have fixed rate mortgages, it doesn't really matter that much. They can refix when interest rates fall, and they can hold tough when interest rates are rising. But for example, in the UK, where you have a lot of people on floating rate mortgages, it does mean that people are at a greater risk. And obviously, those people who have bought to let and are on the cheapest mortgage available, which is often the floating rate mortgage, are at greater risk as well. I don't know where the tipping point is. I don't think anybody does. And one thing that we can be sure of is that over the last 20 years, property, particularly here in the UK and certainly in the Anglo-Saxon world, has been without the shadow of a doubt the best asset class to be in for the longer term. So that does offer a degree of comfort because a lot of people are using equity withdrawal from their houses to support their consumer spending, and the consumer is the king of just about all economies today. That means the central banks will work in the interest of the consumer economy. They're not, it's not in the interest of any economy to see a housing crash, which means that central banks will work to prevent that. But with rising interest rates and the risk of greater bankruptcies or greater defaults, it does mean that we've probably seen the end of the time when property is going to outperform every other asset class. So I don't think there's going to be a crash. We might see a correction at some point, but I don't think we're going to see a crash because if we saw anything like the threat that would lead up to a crash, you would have central banks moving in very, very quickly to store up the housing market. But I do think that we're probably close to an end of when property is going to outperform just about everything else. Anyway, that's pretty much it for me. I hope everyone has a very good weekend, and thank you for your time.